When it comes to Wisconsin's upcoming race for Senate, it can seem like the two candidates, Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold, couldn't be more different. And there's one issue in particular that stands out these days: national security.
That issue took a back seat 5 years ago when the two candidates first squared off. But as of right now, anyway, it's looking like it's going to be front and center this time around, in part because of terror attacks in Paris and in California. According to our next guest, the rematch could give us the sharpest, starkest debate over war, terrorism, and America's role in the world of any Senate race out there in the country in 2016.
Craig Gilbert joins us now. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and writes the Wisconsin Voter blog about politics and elections. Craig, welcome back.
Nice to be with you.
How far apart are Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold and their ideas about national security?
Yeah, they really don't have a lot in common. I mean, they don't have a lot in common on most issues, but there's a few things going on here. One is the possibility of national security playing a bigger role post-Paris and after the California attacks and the rise of ISIS than it did in the first Feingold-Johnson election in 2010. Two, you've got two senators with a lot of differences on foreign policy and national security. And three, you also have two senators that, you know, have a platform and a history on these issues. I mean, Johnson is the chairman of the Senate Homeland Security Committee, and he is also serving on the Foreign Relations Committee after coming into politics with no foreign policy experience. And Feingold has a long history on these issues, the votes he's taken. He wrote a book about 9/11 and the response to 9/11. He served as a diplomat in the Obama State Department. So it's really kind of in a lot of ways, a model debate, a clear contrast in a year when, like I said, national security could be a factor.
Well, how big do you think it could be? Let's say that national security, the threat of terrorism, keeps on looming large as we get all the way up to that November deadline. How big do you think the impact could be when we take stock of how voters are going to feel come ballot day?
Well, you have to sort of accept the fact that it normally does not play much of a role. I mean, political scientists will tell you that it's just really the economy is most times a much more dominant driver of how people vote. It takes a special set of circumstances, you know, like a 9/11 kind of attack or being in the middle of a major war, for foreign policy and national security to play a bigger role. And that those ingredients could be in place, but we don't know because, you know, we're speaking right now in the kind of aftermath of Paris and San Bernardino. But a year from now, or 10 months from now, we don't know if national security will be an even bigger deal or whether it will have receded. I mean, so you have to, I don't want to overstate it, but compared to elections in the recent past, you know, when you certainly 2008, 2010, 2012, and 2014, it just has not been a major factor in presidential and midterm elections. And there's a chance it could be a bigger factor this time around.
Well, given the stage that's being set right now, do you see this race as being the biggest race for Senate seats come 2016?
It's definitely in the top two or three. You know, kind of depends on how you define it. But, you know, I think most people think of Mark Kirk from Illinois as being the most vulnerable incumbent, certainly the most vulnerable incumbent Republican. But then Ron Johnson would be right up there behind him. And when you consider the fact that, you know, Ron Johnson is an incumbent who has been polling consistently behind his challenger, Russ Feingold, in the polls that, for example, the Marquette Law School has done. And when you consider Wisconsin's history in presidential elections of voting Democratic, and when you consider how long it's been since Republicans in Wisconsin won a Senate race in a presidential year, those are all very tough things for Ron Johnson to overcome. And I think Republicans are hoping that one factor that could boost him is national security and foreign policy. If this turns out to be kind of a liability for Democrats 10 months from now.
Now, you spoke with both these guys recently. How do they see each other in broad strokes when it comes to national security?
Well, there's always, you know, kind of people tend to paint their opponents with very broad brushes. And some of this kind of fits in the classic Democratic and Republican kind of stereotypes. But if you talk to Russ Feingold about Ron Johnson, he views him as somebody who's just kind of knee-jerk, goes to the military solution, unilateral, hasn't learned kind of some of the lessons of the past about the costs of boots on the ground. If you talk to Ron Johnson about Russ Feingold, he doesn't take national security seriously, he's voting against the Patriot Act, and other issues. He's not tough enough, and we shouldn't be ruling out. I mean, there are real policy differences there when you get past the rhetoric. I mean, there's clearly a difference about, you know, how they talk about military force. I mean, Ron Johnson has explicitly said, you know, significant numbers of U.S. troops to go into Iraq and Syria to displace, to try to displace ISIS and take their territory away. Russ Feingold, who was one of the votes against the Iraq War in 2003, absolutely opposed to that idea. There's probably some common ground when you get past that. They both want to beef up intelligence. In some ways, the difference between President Obama and his critics on actual concrete policy steps to fighting ISIS are not as dramatic as you might think from the rhetoric. But this is one area where some Republicans are calling for boots on the ground, and President Obama has ruled out, you know, major ground forces. That's clearly one area of difference.
We're talking to Craig Gilbert right now from the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. He recently wrote a piece exploring the different approaches being taken by Russ Feingold and Ron Johnson on the issue of national security. And he says that the rematch between the two of them could give us the sharpest debate over war, terrorism, and America's role in the world of any Senate race in the country in 2016.
You can join in with your questions and your comments at 800-642-1234. If you're an undecided voter, will national security be one of the biggest issues on your mind as you think about which candidate you'll vote for? If you've already made up your mind between Johnson and Feingold, whose approach to national security do you favor? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking right now with Craig Gilbert of the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. He recently wrote a piece on the issue of national security in Wisconsin's U.S. Senate race.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Will national security be on your mind, do you think, at the ballot box in 2016? And if so, what will determine which candidate you vote for? And whose approach to national security do you agree with, at least thus far? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Craig, let's look at the candidate's approach to the aftermath of 9/11. In this case, Russ Feingold was a sitting senator and voted as a lone vote against the Patriot Act. How did Russ Feingold frame that vote now, and how does Ron Johnson see it?
Well, the Patriot Act is an interesting issue because it does cross some partisan lines. As you mentioned, Russ Feingold was the only vote in the Senate against the Patriot Act. Jim Sensenbrenner, who was chairman of the House Judiciary Committee at the time, was the lead author on the Patriot Act. But you jump ahead to 2015, and there's kind of a bipartisan effort led by Jim Sensenbrenner to moderate the Patriot Act and to curb at least one kind of significant surveillance power in the Patriot Act, which is the kind of mass collection of phone records that tell that indicate, you know, who Americans have called and when they called, the duration of their calls. So Congress, on a big bipartisan vote, passed a law this summer to end the bulk collection of phone record data. Ron Johnson voted for that bill, but he kind of voted for it holding his nose. He voted for it because he said it was the only way to preserve some other aspects of the Patriot Act, but he says he would support something that Marco Rubio is going around proposing, which is to basically undo the Sensenbrenner tweak and restore this particular power for the government to collect and store phone records. So there is a difference between the two candidates on that issue, but it's a difference that does cross some party lines because you have some Republicans on the right kind of agreeing with Feingold and agreeing with Sensenbrenner that the Patriot Act went too far and that there are at least some surveillance powers in the Patriot Act that ought to be curbed. Ron Johnson takes a slightly different view there.
And I guess it's worth asking at this point, if you had this conversation with Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold before the Pera attacks, before the California attacks, wondering if any of that changed, if their opinions on surveillance, government surveillance, might have changed in the wake of those
terrorists. Yeah, well, no, I mean, I talked to them both since the Paris attacks, and I kind of talked to them the week of the California attacks. But no, I don't think that would change. I think, in fact, I think that Ron Johnson would say the Patriot Act needs to be stronger, and he would say the government needs this particular surveillance power that I just talked about. But again, Jim Sensenbrenner would tell you otherwise. It's also a case that, you know, it's a power and a tool that the government had before the Paris attacks and leading up to the California attacks. It really wasn't until about a week ago that that the government was effectively banned from collecting these records, and even now they can still get those records from the phone companies. It's just they can't store them. So, you know, sometimes these issues, which when you look at them, may not have a profound impact on terrorism, take on a big political significance because of the symbolism they have. And again, the interesting thing about the Patriot Act issue and about some of these issues that get to civil liberties and surveillance powers is that they don't follow clean kind of ideological and partisan lines. You've got sometimes liberals like Russ Feingold and conservatives like Jim Sensenbrenner on similar sides.
And then another aspect of this race is how both candidates feel about the American invasion of Iraq. What did they say about how they're framing that, how they feel about it?
Well, Russ Feingold was on the was in the Senate when, of course, we invaded Iraq under President Bush, and he was a very vocal opponent. He was also somebody that opposed the surge in 2007 and that for a long time was supporting and calling for troops cutbacks and faster withdrawal than we ultimately had. Ron Johnson is, you know, when you ask him about the 2003 invasion of Iraq, he basically says, you know, I wasn't in the Senate. What's passed is passed. That's not really the issue anymore. He does take a position on the surge and on the withdrawal from Iraq and argues that Russ Feingold may argue that it was the original invasion of Iraq that kind of sowed the seeds for ISIS. Ron Johnson would say it was our pullout after the surge that kind of opened the door for ISIS. So there's kind of a different reading of history there. And obviously, as we discussed before, big difference on whether we should put boots back on the ground and try to kind of displace ISIS in Syria and Iraq and find a way to hold that territory to keep them from coming back.
And history aside, we are where we are. ISIS is a threat in the world today. And as we wrap up, how do the two candidates want to deal with ISIS? How does that distinguish them?
Well, they both want to, I think they both think that our intelligence should be beefed up and that should be better than it is. I think they both probably support a lot of things, a lot of different kinds of initiatives that have broad support when it comes to kind of cutting off the finances and the oil and other things. But the biggest difference, again, is this is sort of on the use of military power and military force in Iraq and Syria, and that is a pretty big difference. And it's a difference, again, what Ron Johnson is calling for is not something that all Republicans support. It's a matter of debate, even in the Republican presidential race, whether we should be committing a sizable ground force to Iraq and Syria or not. But it is a difference in this Senate race, and it's one of the reasons why the contrast between these candidates is so stark on this and other issues, some of the issues we haven't even discussed, like Iran and the nuclear deal.
Craig, we leave it there. Thank you for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
That was Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he writes the Wisconsin Voter blog about politics and elections.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we look back at 5 years of fact-checking by PolitiFact Wisconsin and what trends they see in the 1,000 claims that they've rated, anywhere between the ratings true to pants on fire.
First, with an aging population and a heavy reliance on a manufacturing industry that's been in decline for decades, Wisconsin faces real challenges when it comes to invigorating its economy.
A Pew report out this year showed that between the year 2000 and 2013, Wisconsin had the fastest shrinking middle class gas in the country. Adjusting for inflation, the median household income fell by almost $9,000. At the same time, salaries are sagging, young workers are leaving the state, and manufacturers are having trouble finding new talent as the workforce gets older.
These kind of challenges are the subject of today's Future Wisconsin Economic Summit held by Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. Here with us now to talk about the summit, what came out of it today, is Jim Morgan. He's president of the WMC Foundation. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
In the preview for this event and in a talk by Todd Berry with the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, the idea came up, okay, what if we stay on our current track, trends continue, we don't change anything? Where do we go if we're in the no-change situation, Jim?
I think after Todd's presentation today, we decided that that's not an option. You know, quite frankly, if we do double our over 65 population and don't have a net in migration of people to fill the job that we're going to have open in the state, it's going to have an impact across the board on health care, on property ownership, on sales taxes, and everything else. And I think Todd opened up an awful lot of people's eyes that it's going to be more important than ever that we figure out not only how to keep more of the people that we've got in Wisconsin who may be leaving for the wrong reasons, and how do we attract people from outside the state. Because we're going to have all kinds of job opportunity, but there's a perception out there that there aren't any jobs in Wisconsin right now.
Well, I want to get into solutions in a minute, but first I want to hammer this problem home a little more. So you've got this almost triple whammy, right? Aging population, a lot of people retiring, younger people not there, some moving away, so nobody to take over those jobs. And then we're going to need more workers to take care of that aging population that's left the job market and maybe need some kind of assistance. So three problems there. How bad is this going to be if we stay on the current course?
Well, it's going to be serious. We're looking at over the next 20 years of taking our over 65 population from 750,000 to 1.5 million. And that's a group of people that's going to need services. At the same time, we're estimating that there will be close to 300,000 job openings and really growth of only about 15,000 people in that 18 to 64 age working group. And I think, as you said, you know, this is a triple whammy. This is sort of the perfect storm that here in the upper Midwest, we're not growing our own population. And so unless we can find some way to bring more people in, make the state more attractive to people, it's going to cost us across the board and an awful lot of things. And it's going to be a spiraling effect.
When it comes to jobs and partisan politics in the state, Jim, it seems like a lot of the conversation is waving around this month or this quarter's job numbers and trying to assign blame or take credit. Do you think we're having a serious enough conversation outside of your event today about these more fundamental structural issues?
Well, I think part of the reason that this is a 20-year strategy is we learned from a couple of our peers in other states. Probably the best example I got was from someone in Florida who said, you know, if you try to have a conversation about energy and look 2 years out, you're going to have, you know, people of global warming in one corner and not global warming in the other, and carbon fuels in the other, and renewables in another corner, and they're all going to just sit and scream at each other. But if you look 20 years out and say, look, we're going to need 35% more energy, how do we get it? Now you start to have a conversation. And I think part of the reason that we're trying to look this time out is to say, look, there are short-term solutions, and we certainly need to begin to work on those. But if we don't all get together on this one and figure it out, it's not going to be, you know, your end of the boat that's sinking and mine's okay. Both ends are going down. And so I think there is more of a constructive conversation going on now that says this is going to impact everybody. These are taxpayers, which means there's not as much money for roads and schools. These are people that are working and trying to create jobs. And everybody either benefits or loses together. And we want to make sure we go down the road to success here. So that's why we've been trying to get all these different groups together.
Talking about today's Future Wisconsin Economic Summit, convened by Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, we've got Jim Morgan with us. So, Jim, trying to plot out this roadmap for the future, I'm assuming all the problems weren't solved completely today. But what kind of approaches are people talking about to attracting young talent, keeping and training young talent in Wisconsin to fill all those jobs?
there's a couple of things that we're starting to uncover here. One is, even with our own kids here in Wisconsin, they don't seem to understand the diversity of the jobs that exist. So I think job one for us is, whether it's through these academic and career plans in the schools or through parents or counselors, we've got to do a better job of explaining to people what the opportunities are, you know, here and right now. We also did some perception surveys just through social media, and, you know, are finding out that our outdoor recreation, our natural resources, are something that people appreciate whether you live in Wisconsin or outside of it. We also know that's something that millennials are attracted to. They like to bike, they like to run, they like to hike. You know, so there may be an opportunity there that we can start selling ourselves a little bit more, because we're traditionally a pretty low-key group in the upper Midwest. We just, you know, sort of say, oh, shucks, everything is great and you should all know about it, but we don't sell ourselves. So we've got to begin to sell ourselves both within the borders of Wisconsin and to people outside.
How do you create that brand? I mean, a lot of things sometimes are beyond your control. It's whatever news story is out there, however a sitcom chooses to represent that yokel character from Wisconsin. How do we control that agenda of what the Wisconsin brand is?
Well, I think we have to begin to speak with one voice, and we actually at the summit today showed a variety of movie clips and interviewed a bunch of students at the university, and you'd be amazed at how some of those stereotypes stick with us. So part of the presentation today was the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation beginning to lay out some different possibilities for how we may brand the state, so we don't have 15 or 20 separate voices out there, but we do come up with one way of speaking about Wisconsin like some other states are doing, because otherwise we're sending mixed messages. And often the way that we're branded is either by a sitcom that's 20 years out of date, or a football game where it's 40 below zero and there's some guy who, you know, is sitting there on TV with his shirt off. We've got to begin to, as all the state agencies, as the business community, as the schools, begin to sell the quality of education here, the quality of the parks here, the quality of family and sense of community and work ethic. Because if we can get people here, we have pretty good success in keeping them.
What kind of things do we know about the sort of amenities that the younger workers want these days? Apart from the natural resources, they're looking, as I understand it, from other guests we've talked to, for quality of life in a town, in a city, a small city. They want a lot of the things that they could get and leave to get in a larger city, Chicago, New York, the West Coast.
Well, and it's interesting, when we were serving people out of state, commute time is a big deal. And I don't think we just sort of take it for granted that you can get, you know, almost anywhere around any city in 10 minutes. And, you know, people are still stuck in their parking lot for that amount of time. It's another thing that we have going for us. We've got cities that are beginning to have industrial bases and jobs grow up around condos and things like that. So they don't have to own a car. They can walk or bike to work. And I think people are starting to understand some of that. We had some people from the group Milwaukee down out of Milwaukee talking about, you know, what do millennials want, and that idea of flexibility. We may need to be offering different things to those types of folks. But we've got something in those natural resources that other people can't just create. And so I think we've got a positive there that we've got to start to build on.
Apart from all that, the quality of life things, people looking at jobs are looking at things like salary. How much are they going to make? Salary and compensation. Is Wisconsin as a whole competitive in those areas? Can we be? What would need to change to make us more so?
Well, one of the things that we actually had in our benchmarks was personal income, and Wisconsin ranks 21st of the 50 states, so we're a little bit above average. But we've also got a little bit of a reputation for being a below average cost of living state. So, you know, my $60,000 in Green Bay goes a lot farther than my $60,000 in Los Angeles, California. And that's another thing that I don't think we've done a very good job of selling, especially to millennials who might just be looking at that number and not looking at the costs that are associated with it. So we're competitive in the salary world, and I think where we end up coming out ahead is if you take the salary and you take the cost of living, Wisconsin ends up being a pretty good place to live.
So when you think of getting back to the brand idea, Wisconsin, if you're thinking of positives, a lot of times people think of the beer, the cheese, the Packers, maybe the, you know, recreation, things like that. But maybe beer and cheese isn't doing the trick anymore. What kind of things would we focus on in terms of the branding?
Well, with the information that the Economic Development Corporation put out there, we've got some things around work ethic and originality and sense of community, which was interesting because, you know, a lot of times when you live in Wisconsin, you think, yeah, well, that's just us and nobody else appreciates that. That was another one that came up with people in other states saying when they think of what Wisconsin is good or what they like about it, it is some of those things. It, you know, you can trust your neighbor. It's a safe place to be. There is a work ethic if you hire someone that they're going to get the job done. You know, a handshake is still good, and that might sound a little bit corny, but when people do business in different places or people have been employed or lived in different places, there is something about the upper Midwest and Wisconsin specifically that it is a little bit different. And people, like I said, if we can get them here, they end up liking it.
Jim, sometimes you bring a bunch of people together at a summit like this and people come out thinking, okay, we just talked for a few hours. Hope that all works out. Sometimes people come out pumped. They're optimistic. They're encouraged by what they're hearing. How do you read the crowd as they left today?
I think that they're excited. I think, you know, when you see up there on the stage at the same time, the Department of Workforce Development, Public Instruction, Economic Development, private colleges, technical colleges, universities, the business community, all on the same stage saying, look, you know, we may not agree on everything, but at least we're mapping out a direction together to try to get somewhere. Again, I think that there's something about that in Wisconsin. I say, okay, look, if everybody's, you know, as long as we're working hard, we're trying to get to the same place, we can have our differences, but we will get there. And I think communities now are taking up that same thing so that their city is saying, okay, how does the school district and the tech college and the university and the business community work together in Fond du Lac and Eau Claire and Wausau? And there's some pretty neat things that are starting to happen as they keep, you know, recreating this. Because we will solve it locally. I mean, it'll be those people getting together and saying, okay, you know, we got to change some things here to make this place more attractive. And I think our goal is to say we're going to try to make the state as attractive as we can. And then once we get them here and get people interested, then Madison and Milwaukee and Green Bay and Eau Claire can all fight over them. But the first thing is to make sure that people know what a great state this is.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
That's Jim Morgan, president of the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Foundation. The group held the Future Wisconsin Economic Summit today in Madison.